Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. Here again in more post-draft analysis, and we're going to talk about something interesting today, which is levels of risk tolerance that may differ between Ozzie Newsome and Eric DaCosta. Here to join me for that is Jim Zipcode. And Jim, this is your topic, so I don't want to kind of hog the spotlight on your topic. Explain it to us.
Well, hi, Ken. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you again. I have been noticing the last couple drafts, potential sources of different. So let me back up. We've been used to thinking of Eric DaCosta as Ozzie Newsome's right-hand man for over 20 years, kind of sitting next to him. And when he took over as GM for the Ravens after Ozzie stepped down, I think most of us fans anticipated kind of a continuation of Ozzie's philosophy, like a draft, drafting for value, hoarding of picks. And I think that we've seen a lot of that, especially with DaCosta's willingness to trade up and down the board, you know, move back if necessary, you know, swap picks. But one thing that has surprised me is that over the years of Ozzie, I think that in the first round, Ozzie was not particularly a gambler in the first round. His picks tended to be conservative, guys who were very high floor guys, that the risk that they wouldn't be able to play in the NFL was very low. But when DaCosta started drafting, it seems to me that his appetite for risk, so swinging for the fences, even at the risk of maybe getting a guy who might bust, but had high upside, DaCosta has seemed to me to be just an avid risk taker, like a hungry gambler looking to roll sevens at the craps table. And so the guys I want to mention are Marquise Brown, who was rehabbing a Lisfranc injury at the time he was picked and also has very serious size concerns.
Yep.
Patrick Queen was, he had less than a full season of experience as a starter for college. So there was a big risk that maybe he didn't know how to play, didn't know how to cover, didn't know how to read his responsibilities. And maybe some risk that he couldn't stand up to the every down punishment at a position like inside linebacker.
A little undersized. And you know, if you really want to talk about this, it's a position where a premium is paid at inside linebacker in the first round. It's often because it's often the defensive signal caller, the leader. And unfortunately, it was absolutely bought at the top of the market in terms of premiums for inside linebackers.
Yeah. And so for an organization that has principally been a Warren Buffett style value investment shop, you know, paying top of the market price is a little bit of a departure. Then we've got Odafe Owe, an edge rusher who had zero sacks in his final season of college. I love the traits, but we can't argue that that's no risk. And then this year we have Tyler Lindebaum, who is a tremendous college player, but he's an undersized offensive lineman with some physical traits that are in the first percentile for his position. Yeah. At weight and arm length and
wingspan.
A lot of
things related to that. So yeah, certainly he's scary in terms of traits to the table here. And what's really scary is he's very, very similar to Garrett Bradbury, who just did not have his fifth year option picked up by the Vikings after, you know, really struggling through 3 years in the NFL.
He's also, I don't want to rag on the Lindebaum pick too much because there's also similarities between Lindebaum and Jason Kelce, who's been phenomenally successful in the league, and Corey Lindley, who's been very, very successful. They're very similar sizes.
Have you ever noticed how whenever somebody has an undersized, under-metriced player, they always want to compare him to the best player who had similarly crappy metrics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't want to mention the 50 other guys who didn't.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know them. You don't know who they are. So you know, you have to take some sort of sample that's representative. And if you look at the first round centers, there really has been a Mendoza line in terms of what length is required. And Bradbury, Billy Price, another complete first round bust with the Bengals, they moved him around a little bit in terms of position, but he should have been able to take the center job for Cincinnati. He never could.
Yeah.
And, you know, the three of them are of similar length. Then you get guys who are above 32 inches in length and Price is at 30
arm length. Yeah.
Price was 32 exactly, and Bradbury was 31.75. Linderbaum 31.25. You get to the longer guys, and you've got three Pro Bowlers all of a sudden in the first round. So it's definitely a trait you want to be very careful of. And I don't want to make that all this show is about, but in terms of the Linderbaum risk, that's where it is. It's can he adjust as many, many others have not. Yeah. In terms of dealing with his lack of length.
Right. I think in our division, the other risk with Linderbaum is whether he can anchor against a really big defensive tackle trying to push the pocket.
By the way, that is largely length related.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
First contact is dictated by these bigger men. Yeah, it makes it much harder to anchor. Yeah.
So I don't want to focus on Linderbaum. I think that he's an extremely talented player. But I think if you look at the set of them, that's four drafts with a first round pick with a question marks, right? And a mm-hmm. a high risk that the pick won't be able to succeed in the NFL at all. Mm-hmm. So let's say low floor picks. And that's really different from the Aussie philosophy, it seems to me.
Right. So probably high variance is the way we would term them, right? These picks have a more of a high variance. Now, in going back on Aussie, I'll ask this as a question, but you kind of got to get the sense that I really already think this is the answer, at least in the picks until 2000, where they had the never fail mm-hmm. Aussie era, basically. Yeah. Travis Taylor, kind of the first one. All of those guys were taken with such high picks, it's hard to fail. Jonathan Ogden was drafted number four. Ray Lewis at 26 was a later round pick that really worked out. And Peter Boulware at number four, Dwayne Starks at number 10, Chris McAllister at number 10, Jamal Lewis at number five, and Travis Taylor at number 10 is really the first of the picks that really didn't work out for the Ravens in the first round.
I forget Travis Taylor's measurable. He was pretty much a big prototypical guy. Wide receiver size. Is that about right?
I think it's 6'1", 200.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely was thought to be a bigger receiver in that era.
Right.
Players like Darryl Boston and Plaxico Burress came along after that, I believe, and really changed the size of the position.
So you're saying at that point in the draft, like nobody who would be a realistic pick at that position was going to have any physical question marks about them? I think that's sort of your point.
Yeah, I think you get mostly high ceiling and high floor on the early first round picks, and you really, if you're going to do anything, you have to measure them against other picks at that level,
right?
And the big pothole that Ozzie avoided was stepping in the big pile of dog crap that Lawrence Phillips' career ended up being. Two metaphors, but you understand what I
mean. Yeah, we spoke very 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 briefly before we fired up this recording, mm-hmm. but maybe that's a good time to bring up the types of risk that there are. So we mentioned Tyler Linderbaum's arm, right? So that mm-hmm. that type of risk, let's characterize that as physical or measurables, mm-hmm. right? Physical traits. Then we've got character concerns. That's our Lawrence Phillips segue. Mm-hmm. We've got something that I'm calling productivity or skills. And that what I'm trying to capture there is the idea of a guy who, maybe Jalen Ferguson is a good example here, who played for a long time in college, had a lot of productivity and had understanding/skills for his position. Now, he didn't succeed in the NFL, but I'm going to say that was primarily, lack of physical or measurables. It's not that he didn't have experience. And then injury, which for me would be the Marquise Brown mm-hmm. situation where the player's injured when he's drafted. Those are the...
Rashad Perriman.
Those are, right, the knee. I forgot the PCL.
Yeah.
So those are the four major types of risk that I just noticed with some of these draft picks.
Those are good categories. And the Ravens have a system that they used to use on their board. I'm not sure if they use it anymore, where they would put a black sticker on a player. And that could mean one of two things. It could mean injury risk, mm-hmm. meaning players coming off an injury, or it could mean off-field or character concerns. They didn't try and differentiate between, but seen the inside of the room after the draft, but still with the dots on the board, and we saw some of those before one of the drafts. So it was interesting that year the Washington Redskins of the time drafted four black dot Ravens players.
So. Is the black dot an undraftable player?
No, in fact, the Ravens had drafted one guy who had that injury risk associated with him was Arthur Jones. Mm. And he had had a serious injury. I think it was a knee also while he was at Syracuse. And they drafted him anyway, but they waited until the fifth round to do it. So it's not a can't draft them. It's a consider this carefully when drafting, I think, is what they're trying to do. And, you know, who even knows if they use the stickers during the thing, but that's also one of the sticker types is the famous red star that goes on players that individual scouts want to advocate for. So they each get to pick either one or two players that they can red star in the draft.
You haven't heard much about red star players in recent seasons. We used to, there was a few years there where we heard a lot about red star players.
Right. I think DaCosta's often talked about, he likes the process of the individual scouts trying to sell each other on certain players.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it's a healthy process to have debate over as many players as you can, not just have one report or two reports or one dominant report even about a player, but you got to sell it to me. You know, it's a great thing we hear in the business world a lot. And I think it's a good thing to use for scouting for sure.
It makes me wonder about the atmosphere in those organizations, sports organizations, because usually those guys have not gone through, I'm going to say gone through the business world, like a training program, an intake program at a Fortune 500 company or something like that. The culture is really, I think those guys like listening to guys argue and hearing guys fight for somebody as if that all by itself is of value.
I mean, I think passion in individuals in any corporate environment that happens. You're in an IT environment, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So
consulting before that.
Yeah. I mean, consulting maybe less so because you have to treat the client with kid gloves and, oh, you were so close and you have all that. But in a normal kind of an actuarial environment, I mean, we're screaming at each other. You make a point about what you think an assumption ought to be or why you think ought to be. And then if you have disagreement, then it can get loud.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's abnormal at all. I think that's true probably in a lot of other places. If you don't have it, it's probably because you have too much dominance by one person, which is also not healthy. Is that one person is just kind of controlling the conversation and giving all the orders. And I don't think that's healthy.
I've not had experience where that kind of argument in a business setting is super helpful. I'm remembering one situation where I got into a yelling match with a database administrator on Codeover go live weekend who didn't want me to have the database administrator's password before we ran the data conversion programs. And that had to be refereed by the project manager because we were just, you could not resolve
it yourself. Huh?
No, we couldn't.
That's okay. You had your tie breaking procedures. That's fine. And I think the important thing a lot of the time is to vet these things and just, the act of actually talking about them is very healthy. Now you got to understand that it's just you're taking two sides of the argument there. But
right,
a lot of sports discussions are really like that. And I guess this is what we're getting back to is in the draft room. We expect that a lot of the discussion does get loud. You know, they do take it into the bathroom with each other, not in a bad way here, but they're when they're on bathroom break, they're still arguing about the players they want to draft.
Right. Yeah, and it's such an imprecise science. Like you're arguing about what a 20-year-old, a 21-year-old is going to become over the next 5 years, which is one of the most volatile possible predictions.
Yep. Yeah,
I made some notes about some Aussie draft picks, and one of them is whether a guy was a prototype or not, and I just mean physically here.
Yeah.
And I noted I think it's about 12 prototypes. Jonathan Ogden, who was the clip art of what an offensive lineman ought to look like. Chris McAllister, Todd Heap for a move tight end. God help me, Kyle Bowler certainly looked like a quarterback. Terrell Suggs, Aloti Nata, Ben Grubbs, Joe Flacco, Jimmy Smith, Ronnie Stanley, Marlon Humphrey. These guys could... You know, if you wanted to establish what the physical ideal is of a player at a particular position, those guys all absolutely look the part.
Yeah. Marlon Humphrey, did you name? I'm sorry, I missed it.
I did.
If you did.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. He definitely belongs in the group.
Maybe Bulware too.
Yeah. Bulware would be the other one that I just looking through all the first round picks here that really says, did you say Jamal Lewis?
I did not. Because
he definitely was
so big.
Yeah. It's very, very unusual to have a physical specimen like him who is a combination of speed and power that Jamal did. Not the highlight level elusiveness of a Sanders or a Sanders, certainly, just an unbelievable small step, big hit running back.
Yeah. I read one of those columns that they do in around training camp. Media types will run them, like, what was your welcome to the NFL moment as a rookie? Mm-hmm. And a guy, a cornerback, was quoted, he's a 5'10" corner. He was quoted as saying, "I came up in run support against the Ravens and Jamal Lewis came around the corner at me." And I don't know if you've seen Jamal Lewis, but that's a big dude.
Yeah, he's definitely was a hell of a back. Probably is not going to quite make the Hall of Fame, but boy, he had a great career with the Ravens, that's for sure.
That season of 2,000 yards was just amazing.
Right. So was that 2000 season. Frankly, came in, didn't start right away, and was fantastic, and, you know, huge single component to that offense. You know, not a great offensive line that year. It got weaker as you went left to right.
O-line, I would say.
Decent, but on the right side, not particularly good with Harry Swain and a mix of players playing right guard. And Swain wasn't even healthy the whole year. You had guys like Spencer Folau getting significant time in there. Jeff Mitchell was okay. Mulitalo and Ogden were the strength of the line on the left side from a run blocking perspective. Mm-hmm. But I would honestly say pretty average offensive line. And I honestly, not a particularly good offensive line for a Super Bowl winning team.
No. But I mean, it's very high standard. I was surprised, though. I was looking at Ravens ranks in DVOA, Football Outsiders, last offseason, trying to get a rank of every Ravens team. You know, which team did DVOA think was the best Ravens squad? Which did they think was the worst? And I was surprised how well regarded the offense for 2000 was by DVOA. Because mm-hmm. I thought it was terrible, and it was not terrible by their rankings. Not great, but...
Right. So that's it. Was it a positive DVOA on offense?
I think it was.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd have to pull up that spreadsheet, and I'm afraid I'd lose the spreadsheet I have right now.
That's fine. I just kind of wanted to know. I know they had a tremendously negative DVOA on defense, which is the good side. That's
right,
what you want.
Yeah. Low numbers. Yeah. Low scoring is there.
So
do you agree? Like, has DaCosta taken on more risk per pick in the first round than Ozzie did over his tenure?
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty clearly true. And if you have picks that you just question right off the back, you know, the Linderbaum pick, I think people question. I think you're right. The OA pick is one that's questioned. Fortunately that one seems to have worked out. So we don't know about Linderbaum yet. Patrick Queen, unfortunately, after 2 years, he's not where the Ravens want him to be.
Right.
I can't imagine that they want to be. He's not where I want him to be. How about that? Is that enough? And then Marquise Brown ended up being a terrific pick, given the fact that they basically got back exactly what they drafted him for.
The post-draft handling of the asset that he represented was perfect. They got back exactly what they spent on him.
Right.
What's the famous thing that Peter King said about him, that, like, you buy a car for $55,000, drive it for 3 years, and then take it back to the dealer and get the $55,000 back for it.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean that the original $55,000 was well spent. That just means that you found a really generous dealer to return it to.
Right. I agree with that. And I have a problem generally when people pair together a good result and a bad result.
Right.
And particularly this happens all the time with draft picks. And they say, okay, we made a great pick, so effectively you're allowed to make a crappy pick. No, you're not allowed to make a crappy pick just because you made a great pick. And the classic time is the 18 first round with Hayden Hurst getting selected at 25 and then Lamar Jackson at 32.
Right.
Jackson pick is a generational pick. And at 32, it was prescient in terms of being able to capture an asset for an extra year that we're just going to be able to afford this year.
Right.
Are going to be enjoy this year, I should say. And Hayden Hurst, they did get back something for him 2 years later, which is good, but is not what you would hope. So
the Lamar Jackson, the greatness of the Lamar Jackson draft pick does not make the Hayden Hurst pick good.
Yeah. Or the fact that they passed on Derwin James.
Right.
So
or DJ Moore.
you know, or DJ Moore, but Derwin James, because, you know, a generational talent. I mean, they didn't make the same mistake this year. I'm really glad to see that
Hamilton, we're talking about risky picks. I'm not mentioning Kyle Hamilton in that group whatsoever.
Right. Me either. And I think that I suppose it could be a risky pick in terms of not being a need pick, but a value pick. Is a value pick ever risky?
I think by definition, not. So Jonathan Ogden was picked at a position that was not a position of need, and they played him at a position, unquote. He could play anywhere at left guard his first season because they didn't have an open tackle spot for him. I would say that Terrell Suggs perhaps was not a pick at a position of need.
That was the thought at the time, is that, you know, hey, we've got pass rushers. Why are we getting Suggs when we need a quarterback?
Yeah.
And I thought that was the plan, I thought, to get Leftwich by making that trade. And then cards didn't get turned in, phones didn't get answered or whatever. And Suggs dropped down and was taken.
Did they did the Ravens organization not make trades with the Bears for a number of years after that
Jimmy Smith thing? Yeah. I don't know what internal rules they have for dealing with the Bears, but
Did I mean the Vikings? I meant to be talking about the Terrell Suggs thing.
Okay. So there was the same problem where they lost a spot on the Jimmy Smith trade, and I think they were pretty pissed about it with the Bears. Yeah. And the Bears even said it's our fault, but the league didn't do anything to them.
Yeah.
So with the Terrell Suggs thing, I think more than likely it was the Ravens who messed up the transaction. Maybe intentionally, maybe not, but they messed up the transaction. They either couldn't decide amongst themselves, or they didn't make the phone call, or certain people really wanted to do it and Ozzie didn't. And it was reported otherwise. Maybe even, you know, like the guy could really see throwing a fit in the Ravens draft room would have been Billick, because Billick really wanted a quarterback.
Yeah.
And they mollified him by trading back into the first round to get Bowler at a very severe cost in terms of the 2004 number one pick. Vince Wilfork was the guy the Patriots selected with that pick. So, I think if you ask people from that era, people will have selective memories about what exactly occurred there. Mm-hmm. Try asking the question of Brian Billick someday. I've gotten an interesting story on that general event that was he was speaking at. And then I wonder if you asked Acosta or if you asked Newsom if they might also tart up what actually happened during that first round. All the drama at 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, it led up to a Suggs draft pick and, you know, the trade not being made. And then why did they go back and go ahead and get Bowler at the end of that round?
Was it 2 years later they drafted Mark Clayton?
There's a risky pick.
well, so I didn't mention opportunity cost as a risk, but Aaron Rodgers went two picks later.
Yeah, he'd been in the green room forever. I mean, people thought those guys would go 1-2, the trades would be worked out, and then a whole bunch of other people. It's almost like the movie. Is it Draft Day, or what if the movie was with Kevin Costner in the Browns draft?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was almost like that. Rodgers all of a sudden had a scarlet letter on him and couldn't be drafted, and had to be dragged off into the commissioner's suite so that he wouldn't have to be sitting in the green room for hours and hours.
Sitting there just scowling harder and harder as every pick goes by. Yeah,
it was a hard day, obviously, for him. But, I like the way they do it now, that they bring in some guys expected to be drafted on day two and even, you know, into the third round. I don't know if they've got anybody they really expect to be drafted in the fourth round, just so they can tier it and say, you know, hey, we know you're not going to be drafted on day one, but enjoy the party with us and come in and, you know, have fun. And you know, be a body, basically, so these other guys don't have to be in here alone.
Yeah. So that one guy doesn't stand out for not getting drafted.
yep. That's it. But Mark Clayton, a 5'10", 190-pound receiver, not a prototypical physical tools guy.
No, but well within wide receiver norms. I wouldn't say especially risky physically, and very productive, very skilled as a college player.
I think I would argue that he was a pretty big risk size-wise at the time, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, I respect your opinion on this. If you'd say, you know, if the Ravens had drafted him as a slot receiver, mm-hmm. I'd say, well, okay, that's a reasonable slot receiver. If he can run a whip route that will lose anybody, that's great. Mm-hmm. But he's really small to be an X receiver or yeah. you know, on the outside anywhere, honestly. And that limited what you can do with the guy. And I think it probably was a risky pick. It obviously didn't really work out. Mark Clayton, by the way, it's not like, you know, obviously he did have Kyle Bowler throwing to him for a lot of his career. His career catch rate, 53%, 52.6% with the Ravens. I mean, that's just completely unacceptable. His yards per target while he's with the Ravens, only 7.0. So, you know, that's not what you want out of a receiver, certainly not what you want out of a number one receiver.
I hate to lay that on him for the reason that you just mentioned, because yep. that's suspiciously similar to Kyle Bowler's completion percentage.
Yeah. There you go. I mean, Clayton should be the guy who's picking you up on that, but I think there were a few too many contested catches in there, and that would not have been an area where Clayton would have been particularly good.
I remember watching Joe Flacco play his first game as a rookie against the Bengals.
Yep.
And I had Kyle Bowler in the back of my mind, and I'm looking at this guy, like, is he going to be able to play? And there's one play in that game. And, you know, I think as a fan, you have little litmus test moments, right, where a guy does one thing and he does it well, and you're like, oh, he's going to be great. And pocket broke down around Flacco, and there were no open receivers downfield. And he took a look to his right, and Todd Heap was open. And Todd Heap is making that motion with your hand, like that your two hands, like, give me the ball.
Yeah.
But he was also very close to Flacco. He was so close that, I mean, like within, let's say, 10 yards, that like the completion was not a problem, but any pass rushers coming at Flacco would be very easily able to redirect to take down Heap. So Flacco turned away from Heap and rolled away from him. I want to say this is to his left. And Heap, if it was a comic book, you could see a gigantic question mark over his head in the thought balloon. Like his body language was like, what is happening? And Flacco rolled away from Heap to increase the space, the distancing, and then he turned back and tossed it to Heap. It was a very much a basketball play, you know, draw the defenders right. away. And I leaned back.
Penetrate and kick out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I leaned back and just raised my hand. I'm like, this guy will be great. Because yeah. he completed the pass to Heap. Having drawn away the defenders, Heap went on to make a nice gain on the play. It's weird the things that you look at that tell you, you know, this guy's processing physical space at a high rate. You know, he's reading the field. He has good instincts. I don't think... Speaking of Flacco, I would not call him a particularly risky pick in the middle of the first round. Certainly his measurables were great. He looked like a pocket passer, you know, big, strong, big-armed guy, able to shrug off tacklers. He wasn't super fast. You know, he wasn't Steve Young. He didn't have, you know, the processing speed of a Brady. I'm not saying it was risk-less, but one could make the argument that he was a significantly less risky pick than say Lamar Jackson was.
Yeah, I think that's probably realistic. I mean, Joe certainly had more of the normal traits looked for in the quarterbacks of the day in terms yeah. of size and arm strength and whatnot. And then you move on to Lamar Jackson and the Ravens really changed the way people looked at quarterbacks in a lot of ways. And it's not like there weren't a couple of them already. Deshaun Watson, I guess, had already been in the league for a year.
Yeah.
I have to look it back.
Year
back
or two. Exactly. I think it was 2 years.
Okay. And then Russell Wilson, of course, had been around, but Lamar Jackson really was the first one they really built the offense around, that they built it specifically for him in terms of a multi-threat guy. Michael Vick, to probably a lesser degree, had that. Vick really, throughout of his career, kind of still tried to be a pocket passer for a lot of it. Never had the number of runs that Lamar did.
Yeah, I think that we maybe a different show here would be whether that was well advised, because I think that Lamar could function very capably in a classic West Coast offense system or an Earhart Perkins offense, and just have the runs be sort of a sidelight, you know, like escape the pocket, you know, break the pocket with the pass rush. But I don't want to dive into that particular rabbit hole.
That's a really good thing to save for another day. The Ben Grubbs pick, and this is something that you look at, is one of the things is positional risk. Mm-hmm. Are you taking a position that has the kind of premium on it in the first round? Because there's certain positions, and honestly, guard and center are both in the group, where it can be very difficult to justify a first round pick on either of those positions. Now, there are players. Quentin Nelson certainly meets the standard to be drafted somewhere in the first round, and there are plenty of other guys who do as well. But it's certainly a position where, despite the fact that there's two starters at that position, it should make up far less than 1/11th, and does make up far less than 1/11th of all first round picks. The seminal moment for me that really kind of bothered me was the first round of 2007, when at number 29, the Ravens were about to be on the clock, and all of a sudden I see number 28 is on the clock currently, and the pick switches to San Francisco is traded for the pick, and I go, oh, crap.
The tackle.
And Joe Staley, of course, he spent a decade as their or more as their left tackle, and the timing would have been perfect because it was the end of Ogden's career right then. At 2007 was his last year, and it would have been perfect. It just would have been perfect to bring him in at that point. They avoided the whole Gaither mess, potentially the whole Orr mess would have been avoided as well. But they got Ben Grubbs, who was a good player for 5 years, but he frankly was not as good a guard as Marshall Yanda, very, very clearly. And I know. By the way, Mike Preston, I think still to this day, thinks that Ben Grubbs was better than Marshall Yanda. He talks about it every so often. It seems to come up. But, there are traits, but I don't know how anybody gets there. I really, at this point, I do not get it.
I mean, certainly over his career, he wasn't. I don't know if it's at all possible that in the first two or three seasons, maybe as a rookie, Ben Grubb was a better guard than Marshall Yanda was. But it's obviously not sustainable for a career argument.
Right.
I'm trying to be polite to Preston to see if there's any way we could say, maybe there was a season there early on.
Right. I think it was after Grubbs was already with the Saints. He's still saying it. But, it's the kind of thing I'm not trying to press this, nor am I trying to beat on Mike Preston, because he's a venerable and very good writer that tries to do a good job with what he's doing. It's just, it's interesting that you can still have different opinions after all these years about these guys. I just think the part of the problem is they got all of the value they could reasonably hope to out of Ben Grubbs. They got his rookie contract. They got I believe a compensatory pick.
Yep. Yep.
That came at the end of that. So, they got 100% of the value you can get out of the pick. And it's still kind of bothersome. It was good. They got as much value as they reasonably could have hoped to get.
But they didn't get Staley.
But they didn't get Staley.
I was mad, too. When the Niners traded in that pick, I started yelling at the TV because he was the guy I was looking at as that pick came down.
Yeah, same thing at our house. And this is how it can get kind of loud. We had a little party over at our house, and everybody kind of left as soon as I started screaming at the TV. It's one of those things that we've got. Sorry, folks.
I was commenting on Twitter about positional value because I believe, I'm not dumb. I see the importance of positional value, obviously quarterback, mm-hmm. Pass rusher, corner, offensive tackle. Those are premium positions for good reason. Mm-hmm. But I do not want to indulge the concept of positional value so much that I would pass up on Kyle Hamilton with him dropping in the first round.
And, that's a good point, because Pete Prisco, real detractor from the Hamilton pick. And he thought, when's the last time that a safety in the first round ever mattered? He goes, I think you have to go back to Ed Reed. Well, Troy Polamalu, I believe, was drafted in the first round. And there have been others since. Personally, Derwin James, for example. Personally, I think if you're getting the top free safety in any draft, I think you generally have to get him in the first round. That's actually, it's a premium position. It's a strong safety. I agree. Basically say, I don't want to do this. But Hamilton definitely, he's more than just a free safety, which I think he could play all by himself. He's a chess piece. You move all over the board and you build your defense around this player. It's not, he's like Jamal Adams and he's like Derwin James in that regard. Even Reed, who was both a strong safety and a free safety, won the Defensive Player of the Year as a strong safety, was more than that, but not the kind of moving chess piece that Hamilton was.
Right. So I would say that for a special player, you have to ignore, like, a special player transcends positional value. Mm-hmm. But maybe the other point is perhaps that free safety has not been adequately recognized in its positional importance.
That's possible. I think you have to get it in the first round in a lot of drafts, I think that maybe we're getting there. But you certainly, there's the limited size and shape positions, like offensive tackle, like quarterback, wide receiver, obviously the top guys, there's a long tail on the right hand side of the curve that people want to draft in the first round. That offensive tackle, there's a big difference, because you got to really check all the boxes for people want to put all their eggs in the basket. And there's a really limited number of people. We look at this draft, there's three guys who stood head and shoulders above everybody else
at tackle.
Yeah. Then there was Penning, mm-hmm. who was the fourth guy, who had a whole bunch of question marks about character, work ethic, all these things from being a, you know, having some boneheaded stuff he did on the field. And then there's everybody else. Tyler Smith got drafted in the first round after, you know, being a guy I had, you know, honestly on my honorable mention list, which is probably wrong. He probably should have been ahead of some other guys like Ryman. I had in the list where I clearly hate the arm length of Ryman. I think he was appropriately, you know, waited until 77 by the Colts. And Deitch was another guy I had in my top 10. He didn't belong there at all. So Tyler Smith should have been higher on my list, but to have him, you know, gravitate all the way into the first round just shows you how desperate people are to get offensive tackles with the proper measurables.
Planet theory. It's Bill, credited to Bill Parcells, that there's only a certain number of people on the planet who have the physical attributes to be able to, you know, play like Jonathan Ogden, play like Aaron Donald, play like, I'm losing it, but that there's a limited number of those humans and you need to grab them when they become available.
We had certainly a fair number of those on the edge in this draft, and the Ravens have had them in past draft. But let's get back to the topic if we can a little bit about differentiating the risk between EDC and Ozzie, because I think we want to kind of tie that together on this show.
Yeah. So, I don't know how to. It was a passing observation that has grown with each draft. Like I noticed it after Marquise, honestly, for DaCosta's first draft, and with each subsequent draft, there just seems to be more risk undertaken. And I think that we can see a motive in it too. So Ozzie drafted for high floor. He often tended to draft for high floor. Perhaps a better way to put that is that he would not tolerate a low floor for a high draft pick.
Sure.
DaCosta, I heard an interview with DaCosta. This is when Ozzie was still the GM. This is before DaCosta took over. It's either a year or two before the transition. And he was interviewed, and one of the things he said that struck with me was that he thought in the modern era that an offense needed, and I don't believe this is the word he used, that an offense needed a freak, at least one freak, that the defense, just a physical type that the defense would have great difficulty matching up with. And so I'm thinking, you know, Jamar Chase, Lamar Jackson.
Skill position player, though, not a lineman.
Correct. Gronkowski, you know, the guys who are innately matchup problems that every offense needed as many of those guys as you can get, but certainly at least one of them, which is an interesting observation. And that makes me think that physical characteristics, traits like speed, are more important perhaps to DaCosta than they were to Ozzie, because those traits create upside. And it seems that DaCosta is really in pursuit of high ceiling guys and is willing to accept a lower floor in pursuit of that than Ozzie was ever willing to accept from his first round picks.
Well, that's the nature of taking big swings as you take chances. I mean, I think you can even look past the first round in this draft and say that David Ajabo.
Yep.
Big swing. And by the way, people are going to consider me polar on Ajabo. I consider myself fairly neutral, because the Ravens certainly could not have gotten a player like Ajabo, even with their number one pick,
yep,
if he hadn't have been injured. So I get that completely. My problem is that I think very practically about how much of the value is jammed into those first 4 years or five right. in the first round. And you never can get that back. Your draft right. capital is paying for exactly that underpayment relative to cap that that player could deliver for you in those first 4 years. And when you give up one of those years, that's bad. When right. you give up development on a player who is quite unpolished as a Jabo is, then it's that much worse. And you know, we've already seen it happen with Patrick Queen. Excuses have been made. We're not looking for excuses to be made for 2023 Ajabo. We need 2023 Ajabo to come right out and start rushing the passer at a high level, at situationally at the minimum.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think with Ajabo, what you have to say is that if you're going to defend DaCosta on this pick, mm-hmm. you have to observe that the Ravens very rarely get the opportunity to draft a player with those traits.
Right. That's true. That's absolutely true. And his ceiling is enormous. And if the Ravens can somehow harvest 2.5 years of outstanding play, that'll be fantastic. If they harvest 1.5 years of top play like they did from Paul Kruger, mm-hmm. it would be a solid pick. So, you know, it has a chance. As a chance to be a solid pick for sure. You know, one of the other questions I have with Ajabo is exactly the injury he's coming back from. Is he going to lose some of the explosiveness and the get off that is his calling card as a player?
I worry about that with J.K. Yeah. Dobbins for this season, but that's yeah. not really related to the draft.
Yeah, but both players it's the argument would be similar in terms of that explosiveness. Is any of that going to be lost after the Achilles is gone? So anyway.
So some of that Ojabo stuff will be mitigated if he comes back this season, if we get
oh, yeah.
something from him in October or November.
Yeah.
And if he gets 2 sacks in the conference championship game any of the next couple years, then I think we're going to be quite pleased with that pick, you know, even if he does leave in free agency.
Absolutely. And the Ravens, I always say this every year with regard to the pick I don't agree with, is the Ravens have earned my trust.
Yeah.
They've drafted so well for all these years. You know, one of the things, just to kind of finish up this thing, you know, you sometimes hear the notion of acquiring extra mid and late round picks the way the Ravens have with the compensatory formula or with trading back and getting additional picks and just getting equivalent JJ value, which is more on any other flatter valuation chart, so that, you know, they're winning those trades in the perspective of what they think the picks are really worth when they trade down. The act of doing that, a lot of people assimilate to lottery tickets. That yeah. all they're doing is just picking up more lottery tickets.
Yeah.
As soon as you say that, you've lost me in the argument. I really can't stand people say that, because that basically says everybody who's drafting is of equivalent talent. Well, we look at the Ravens' history. That's complete bullshit. Right. I've had a discussion with somebody online. He's a PFF guy who said basically, look, they're all lottery tickets. You can go back to the beginning. And I said, look, the Ravens have consistently done this. They've consistently outdrafted. And they said, well, it's different people who've done the drafting. No, it hasn't. It's actually been Ozzie and DaCosta the entire time. You can sprinkle a little of Phil Savage in there in the early yeah. years. And sure, they had other guys like Joe Douglas who were good scouts and whatnot. But basically, it's the same guys making right. the top level decisions the whole way through.
Right. Would it be fair to equate them to, you know, if you could buy lottery tickets where like one ticket had a greater than even chance, you know, so not all lottery tickets are created equal.
I've like got an analogy for you.
Or a 10X. Go ahead.
I've got an analogy for you. So there's a great poker player out there, Harrington, who's written a number of books about poker. And I try to remember his first name, but I can't do it right now. This is bad. He's a Massachusetts guy though. And what he says about it is very salient. He says, you know, we've all got a $10,000 entry into the main event of the World Series of Poker. It's just, mine is worth the equivalent of about 4 tickets, and a lot of these other people is worth about the equivalent of about a quarter ticket. and it's probably not that extreme in no. the NFL draft, but that's a similar thing. And I think that's the idea you're getting at, is that, you know, some tickets just have a better chance to succeed. And
well, I'm talking about first round versus fourth round and fifth round. Like, okay. Not all lottery tickets are equal, because in this case, the pick values, like, there are different pick values here.
That's true. But I'm even saying, like you have all 32 teams could make pick number 100. And the 32 teams in the NFL, based on the composition of their scouting and whatnot, are going to do a different quality of job in making that 100th pick.
I would rather have Ozzie / DaCosta's pick 100 in any draft than, say, for example, the Texans pick 100 in any draft.
That's fair enough.
That's the point that you're making.
That's right? The point I'm making is that they're going to do a better job with those. They have higher value lottery tickets or whatever we want to call. We've lost this or beaten this analogy to death, I think, as far as we can.
Well, Jim, I know that you want to wrap up, and I wanted to ask you really quick: is there anything about risk that you would like to say about the punter pick in the fourth round from this draft?
There are definitely risks associated with Jordan Stout. It's
those are opportunity cost risks.
Some because they had a chance to take a receiver that they liked. I think it was Austin that went to the Cowboys. Yeah. So they had a chance.
Steelers.
The Steelers, you're right. Steelers. It's worse because it's in division, so it's like a head-on-head pick. Right. Good chance he ends up being a good player for them. I think they had some floor gain out of this was that they're going to get a punter who will cut their cap by a couple million right off the bat, and that has some positives that they get out of it. Here's the risk: is that if he cannot deliver 97% of the Hall of Fame holding ability of Sam Cook, then the Ravens could lose in their kicking game, and that would be really sad. I don't think he'll disappoint as a punter. I think he's going to be, 80% plus of what they want, and he's enough better than the average punter in the league that would be pretty impressive, even towards the bottom end. But I do think there's a risk that as a holder he doesn't end up being the guy they need. Now, I do kind of trust not only that. Cook will probably help him to figure it out, but also that the kicking coach Brown is going to do a really good job of teaching him what Sam Cook knew, and that Tucker himself can help teach him what he knew. So I'm hoping that between Randy Brown and Tucker, they'll be able to work it out.
I often thought that when a wide receiver came to, say, the Patriots or Indianapolis or the Saints, that the wide receiver would go where Mr. Brady or Mr. Manning or Mr. Brees told them to go at the time he tells them to go to it, or he will not be around for long. And I kind of think that Justin Tucker's holder is perhaps in a similar situation.
Yeah, he might be. And, I don't know what else they could do about it. I mean, maybe they have another guy. Maybe it's Huntley, the backup quarterback. Could be the holder if it's not Stout. But there aren't really a lot of other options. I mean, generally speaking, your punter has to be your holder.
Supposedly at his pro day, Stout did nothing but hold. He didn't punt at all.
Well, he didn't hold at all, or not that I'm aware of anyway, during his college career. He was the kicker himself. So that obviously was an unanswered question coming into this draft. And
it's intelligent of him to address it pre-draft.
Yeah, you're right. All right, Jim, absolute pleasure to talk football with you. Always love to get together and have these conversations. Let's make sure we have more of this offseason. I'm sure we got lots of topics we can cut on, including the one we kind of short-circuited earlier in this, I think would be fun to talk about. Tell folks where they can talk football with you.
Well, I'm on Twitter. I've been distracted by the Terrapins' search for a new basketball coach and their recruiting tribulations this year. Perhaps have been sublimating from the disappointing end from the last Ravens season, but I'm starting to be interested in football again. So you can find me on Twitter. That's @zip_Jim, or just look among the people who are liking Ken's tweets, and you'll find me there.
That's nice to say. Thank you. Other folks out there, if you want to be on a film study short this offseason, I'm looking for people to do it, particularly if you have even a series of shows you'd like to do. I'm into that. So give me a DM on Twitter. They're always open. Love to hear from you. I'll get back to you very quickly. And we'll be talking about how to get you recorded and on a show. But really enjoy talking football with a multitude of people. And this has proven to be a very useful way to find new people, find new discussions that are interesting, and just enjoy talking football. So, Jim, thanks again for coming on.
Ken, thank you so much.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.